We've heard from many different people in the previous episodes of this podcast. From Lionel Crabb's unreliable mate, Sidney Knowles. From Portsmouth-based reporter, Peter Marshall. And we've heard from experts like Dr. Richard Shepherd, who guided us through the autopsy on Crabb's corpse. And Crabb expert, Anne Bevan, who knows more than anyone about the whole mystery. But there's one person who so far remains silent, and that's Lionel Crabb himself. We know he gave some radio interviews in the 1940s, but do those programmes still exist? And how would we even find them? Our junior producer, Martha Miller, is on the case, starting with the BBC. But it's a long shot.
So, when I contacted BBC Archives, they originally said that there are two remaining fragments of a BBC Home Service recording from 1949, and this programme...
Martha has managed to find a radio listings magazine from that year, which gives more information about the programme. It was called The Frogman, and it was about an underwater expedition led by Crabb.
And that is mentioned in the programme.
And Martha's just been sent the only surviving clip from the programme. It's on her laptop.
And you think that could be Lionel Crabb?
I think it could be, based on what the Radio Times programme references. And in this clip, there's a man who's talking about this work, which makes me think, this is the person, this is Crabb.
This is brilliant digging. OK, we've got to hear this voice now.
You need to picture the scene. Crabb is in a BBC recording studio in London. A small room, he's sitting at a wooden table. He's almost certainly wearing a tie, because this is the BBC. He moves closer to a chunky old microphone, clears his throat, begins to talk. And as he does so, this is all going to sound quite technical, but the microphone is capturing the vibrations in his voice, transferring them to a precision blade that's etching the finest of grooves into a rotating disc of what looks like shiny black plastic. Those etched grooves, they're like magic. They're capturing the rise and fall in Lionel Crabb's voice, the tremors, the vibrations. They're capturing him. And as long as that master disc survives, Crabb's voice will always be with us, forever. So here he is.
Much to my surprise and horror, I sighted a nasty cylindrical object, about 2.5 feet long, clamped to the bilge keel alongside the engine room.
He's talking about prizing a mine off the bottom of a ship with the help of a fellow diver.
It was December and cold. The mine had 3 clamps. 2 came adrift easily, the 3rd jammed. It took leading seaman Bell, the BEM, and myself, diving alternately, 3/4 of an hour to free the obstruction.
It's unsettling to hear his voice, and so different from what Sarah and I were expecting. No trace of the humble background, the poverty, the lack of formal education. Crabb's adopted, quite deliberately, the formal tones of the BBC. And as I listen, I can't help smiling at the fact that in the only clip of Crabb that we have, which lasts just 47 seconds, he talks twice about alcohol. First here.
I looked, backed away, and surfaced. To warn the ship, to get a line, and thanks to the mate, a drink of rum.
And then here.
It also took the remainder of the mate's bottle.
And that's it. Less than a minute. But though it's short, it sends a shiver down my spine, listening to him talk. After all this time, after all our research, it's him.
Much to my surprise and horror.
I'd always hoped to rebuild Lionel Crabb, and now, here he is, sitting in the room with me.
I looked, backed away.
But it's him at the height of his fame. It's 1949. And much would change for Crabb over the next few years. Because by 1956, as we now know, he's penniless, adrift, and drinking heavily. Crabb's fall from grace was known to a wide number of people, They knew he was vulnerable. But one thing is sure, they also knew he was a man desperate to be part of the action once again, to be the hero again. So who picked him for such a risky mission? And were they seeking to exploit him? I'm Giles Milton, and from Something Else and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Cover Up Season 1, Ministry of Secrets. Episode 7, Dodgy Dickie Strikes Again.
Springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly clean homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at Simply Safe Home Security, the home security system many of the most anxious people I know recommend. Here's why people love it. Trusted by experts, Simply Safe was named Best Home Security System for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. And Newsweek awarded it Best Customer Service in Home Security. The system blankets your whole home in protection. It has sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property, day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than a dollar a day, so you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. Simply Safe has given many of our listeners real peace of mind. I want you to have it too. Get 20% off any new Simply Safe system when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring. Just visit simplysafe.com/coverup. That's simplysafe.com/coverup. There's no safe like Simply Safe.
The world of espionage is as murky as the waters of Portsmouth Harbour. And the Secret Service, that's MI6, is a completely closed world. A world of gentlemen insiders, Eton, Oxford and all that. But while they looked like gentlemen, those intelligence agents, some were gentlemen who played dirty. And there's one name within MI6 that keeps cropping up, online, in newspaper articles, in books, and always in relation to the final dive of Lionel Crabb. That man, he was one of the most senior agents working for MI6. He organised clandestine missions from MI6 headquarters in central London, just a stone's throw from Whitehall. And he'd been posted all over the world, Turkey, Switzerland, Austria, at critical times during and after World War II. He saw himself as a master of espionage, and he was rumoured to be the prime suspect in planning Crabb's final dive. But no one has ever been able to confirm this for sure. And his name? Nicholas Elliott. So who was he?
My father had a very conventional English upper-class upbringing.
This is Mark Elliott talking about his father in a BBC documentary filmed nearly 10 years ago.
He was happiest in an all-male environment all throughout his life. He loved Eton, he loved White's Club, an all-male club. So in a sense, he was an interesting mixture of a very conventional person. Eton, Cambridge, and he had a streak in him that was unconventional and somewhat risky. He was something of a risk taker.
Mark Elliott's now in his late 70s and living in America. I tried to contact him to find out if his father was directly involved in the Crabb mission, but he didn't reply to my email. And as for others who knew Nicholas Elliott and the way he worked, well, there are very few people still alive. There was the late John le Carré, the ex-spy and author of countless spy thrillers set in the intelligence world. But he died a few years ago. He did, however, write a short account of his impressions of Elliott, a man he knew well.
I never once saw him in anything but an immaculately cut dark three-piece suit. He had perfect tone in manners and delighted in human relationships. He was thin as a wand and seemed always to hover slightly above the ground at a jaunty angle, a quiet smile on his face and one elbow cocked for the martini glass or cigarette. Nicholas Elliot of MI6 was the most charming, witty, elegant, courteous, compulsively entertaining spy I ever met. In retrospect, he also remains the most enigmatic.
Enigmatic, charming, but also a risk-taker. So was Nicholas Elliot directly involved in the Crabbe mission?
The Crabbe affair, as we know, caused a complete rumpus. I mean, led to the...
Richard Norton Taylor is in his late 70s. He's an investigative reporter specialising in the world of intelligence. We've been looking for someone who knew Elliot personally. And finally, we've tracked him down.
Well, I got to know of him because I was writing at the time.
Richard was intrigued by Nicholas Elliot.
He had an aura about him because he went to Eton, as we know, and he was quite a cavalier person. He was not kind of maverick, but he was one of the kind of swashbucklers, really. Supremely confident, didn't obey the rules anywhere. You can imagine the kind of person who MI6 revelled in employing then.
And one day, Richard tells me, Elliot invited him to lunch at, you guessed it, one of those private gentlemen's clubs in central London, the Travellers Club.
Of course, Travellers Club in Pall Mall, which is the club for spies, of course.
A club for spies, MI6, where missions are planned, where secrets are traded. So Richard and Nicholas Elliot are sitting together in the club dining room, a fine bottle of claret on the table, white tablecloth, silver cutlery. And Elliot's a peculiar mix of supreme confidence and nervous energy.
He was kind of a rather emaciated figure, chain-smoking figure, clearly desperate to smoke in between every mouthful, let alone every course.
So I ask Richard, how much was Nicholas Elliot involved in Lionel Crabbe's mission?
He knew all about it, and certainly I would say Elliot was one of the who was giving lots of nods and winks. And, well, as I said, you know, working like a club, no accountability, which obviously he enjoyed very much and had done as a privileged member of the, well, sort of upper middle classes, I suppose, and Eton and all that. But, you know, he was a bright guy and he was supremely confident, and MI6 then was certainly not held to account for much.
But it sounds like he was rather good on putting on deflecting anything from him, though.
Yes, I think that's right.
And there's been rumours, never proved, of, you know, this was actually a rogue operation. It hadn't been officially sanctioned.
It was a rogue operation. They'd given a promise. I mean, or MI6 certainly had promised, and they would, or were told not to do anything naughty. And there's Nicholas Elliot and his gang of doing what the fuck they wanted. That was hugely embarrassing.
So it was indeed a rogue operation, because, as Richard put it, Nicholas Elliot and his gang were doing what the fuck they wanted.
And so you get all these people. They weren't cowboys so much. They're just very British, presumptuous, exceptionalists, entitlement, all that stuff, which is, of course, still remnants of this in parts of the British establishment now.
So I ask him, what did Elliot tell him about the operation going wrong, about Crabbe's death?
He had no sort of regrets, really. He had no regrets. It's just rather bad luck. Crabbe was found dead without a head.
But what did Nicholas Elliot and his MI6 insiders want from this mission? What was it all about? According to Peter Marshall, our Portsmouth-based reporter, it was all to do with Soviet technology. You see, Khrushchev's vessel, the Orjon Ikidze, was said to be fitted with these extraordinary, new and powerful state-of-the-art engines with a completely revolutionary design. Top Soviet scientists had worked for years on this groundbreaking new system. And now, that technology was birthed in Portsmouth Harbour. And obviously, Nicholas Elliot wanted to know more.
They were specifically trying to discover the propulsion means which made the Orjon Ikidze faster than any other ship of its class. And it was to do with the way that the the screws that the engines drove were apparently housed in tunnels under the ship. And this was able to give more greater thrust to the speed of the ship.
This extra speed, it meant that Soviet vessels were now faster than British ones. This was the height of the Cold War, and there were tensions everywhere. And in any military confrontation, it put the Soviets at a massive advantage. So why did Nicholas Elliott choose Lionel Crabbe for the Portsmouth Harbour mission? Why him specifically? Remember, this was a rogue mission, and no one must know about it. And that meant Nicholas Elliott couldn't use serving Royal Navy divers. He needed someone deniable, someone retired, someone like Lionel Crabbe. Here's Crabbe expert Anne Bevan, who says that when he left the Navy...
He was kept on a list of useful people. I call them Teflon people, so that if anything had gone wrong, nothing stuck because he was no longer associated with the Navy. And he probably also would have been quite cheap to hire because they knew he was always in financial difficulties. And he would have jumped at the chance of doing anything for money, and especially getting down here, meeting all his mates again and getting back into the water.
It's highly likely Nicholas Elliott knew about this when he planned the dive, knew that Crabbe would eagerly volunteer. But that still leaves Bernard Smith, the man who accompanied Crabbe from London to Portsmouth, who checked in with Crabbe at the Sallyport Hotel. He remains one of the great mysteries in the Crabbe mission. He certainly intrigued Peter Marshall, that Portsmouth-based reporter. So I ask Marshall, did he try to track down Bernard Smith?
We tried, but we couldn't find anybody who knew anything about him. But he spoke with an American accent and nobody quite knew his background. Nobody interviewed him at all.
But Peter Marshall grew increasingly convinced Bernard Smith was some sort of link man between London and Washington.
And the fact that the American television and press were very keen on the story, and I was doing work for them or with them, and they sent their people down to Portsmouth to, you know, find out more about it. And they were intrigued by the story of the mysterious man. And so that tended to sort of, in my mind then, confirm the fact that I thought the Americans had an involvement in this story somewhere.
But could this really be possible? Could the Americans also have been involved in Lionel Crabbe's mission? Was this a joint MI6 CIA operation? Some years ago, I was introduced to a British intelligence agent, a spy. He's retired now and doesn't mind me naming him, Michael Smith. And I get back in touch with him because of the Lionel Crabbe story, and he agrees to have a chat.
So I joined the intelligence corps, and it was signals intelligence.
Michael's bald, stocky, and has an endearing twinkle in his eye, like he knows every secret under the sun. Michael spent many years of the Cold War eavesdropping on the Soviets from his base in Germany.
It's a sort of cat and mouse operation there, where you're chasing these people up and down the airwaves. You're building up an intelligence picture.
At the time of the Lionel Crabbe adventure, there's a name keeps cropping up, and it's this chap called Bernard Smith. And the rumour is that, in fact, this dive under Khrushchev's vessel was actually a joint MI6 CIA operation. And I just wondered, could there be any plausibility to that?
Yes. Yes, it's obviously plausible, yeah. Yeah, they were working together very closely throughout the 50s.
Michael says the CIA would have been pushing to get one of their men involved, a man like Bernard Smith.
They would have worked together, they would have been discussing it together. And yeah, there could well have been pressure from the Americans, who couldn't care less about state visits. See, if the CIA wanted this done, then MI6 might have said, OK, let's put something together.
Michael says the CIA's involvement helps explain why Nicholas Elliott chose someone like Lionel Crabb to do the dive. Because what they put together, it was a top secret operation, even within the CIA and MI6. In fact, it was so secret that those organising it decided to use people who couldn't be traced, like ex-spies who'd retired and were off the books.
It just goes to the point that they were trying to keep it completely secret and not let anyone know about it, because actually, of course, the right person to do it would have been a Royal Navy diver, not Lionel Crabb.
So we know that Nicholas Elliott most likely planned Lionel Crabb's dive in partnership with the CIA. But how free was Elliott to act on his own initiative? Nowadays, MI6 has to act within the law. But how was it in the 1950s?
It was a very, very different time. Very often, schemes behind the scenes were devised and worked on and carried out that the government wouldn't know anything about, and didn't, in those days, necessarily have to accord with the law.
I asked Michael if he's surprised by the Lionel Crabb mission. The fact that the Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, said he had nothing to do with it. In this period, is that exactly the sort of operation that would be taking place?
Yeah, I think it is exactly the sort of operation that would be taking place, but I suspect it was ordered by MI6 chiefs. I don't see any political person ordering it, because I don't believe for a minute that anyone in government would authorise that operation. Not at that time, not during a state visit.
And what of Nicholas Elliott's role, the enigmatic charmer within MI6, the man who loved to take risks? Was this one risk too far? An operation so badly planned from beginning to end that it was always likely to go wrong, always likely to be a cock-up.
Elliott was an idiot. You've got already an extraordinarily incompetent operation. But equally, it was stupid to do it, you know, when Khrushchev was on a state visit. And it's very embarrassing for the government if things go wrong, which, of course, famously they did.
But this still leaves one outstanding question. If it wasn't Anthony Eden, who gave Nicholas Elliott his orders? Who was his boss?
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I want to leave the world of the 1950s for a moment. Jump forwards to the here and now. Take you to the world of Whitehall today. The world of those government ministries in the heart of London. Because it's important to peek inside today's Whitehall establishment. See who exactly is blocking the Lionel Crabb file from being made public. Remember, they've had almost 70 years to release that file, but they're intending to block access to it until 2057. So Sarah and I have come to the home of Sonia Purnell, political biographer and former Whitehall correspondent. She's enormous fun, with a broad smile and a mass of blonde hair.
I've looked and watched Whitehall for a very long time. I used to cover it for two newspapers, The Telegraph and The Daily Mail. My father worked in Whitehall.
And she's steeped in this forbidden world, probably knows it better than anyone else. She's promised to give us an insider's view, tell us who inhabits it, how they keep things secret. The Whitehall establishment today, she says, it's almost impossible to penetrate. And it's remarkably similar to how it was in the 1950s.
That world is an extremely closed one. It's very incestuous. Most of them have been to the same schools, the same universities. Often they've known each other since childhood. They may well have done exactly the same degree. They may have had the same tutors even. David Cameron, the former Prime Minister, the former Foreign Secretary William...
Sonia reels off names of the most powerful people in recent times. Prime Ministers, heads of departments, top political journalists.
People don't hold each other to account. If you've propped up the student bar for 3 years with someone else, it's difficult to take them seriously, perhaps. Or if you do take them seriously, it's difficult to ask them questions and really hold them to account. So this is why it matters.
If something goes wrong, if there's a crisis, if a minister has to cover something up, that's presumably going to be quite easy because the paperwork will never leave the building. It will simply disappear.
So there's always a tension between that secrecy and this great sort of civil service tradition of taking minutes of everything. But yeah, I think things do disappear quite frequently when convenient. Britain has an exceptional culture of secrecy, of government secrecy. It has always done. We've always had a pretty severe Official Secrets Act that makes so many things secret that actually don't need to be.
It's hard to believe she's describing Britain today, a country still controlled by a tiny Whitehall elite, many of whom are old friends and constantly looking out for one another, ensuring damaging paperwork will never see the light of day. I ask Sonia about a disturbing rumour that Sarah and I have heard, a rumour that deep inside Whitehall, at the very inner circle of power, there's a small group of insiders whose sole task is to stop secrets from ever escaping from Whitehall. These people, I asked Sonia, do they actually exist? She says she's also heard these rumours, heard that there's some sort of Ministry of Secrets at the heart of Whitehall, but she's never been able to discover more.
You find something out about them, tell me, because I have long wondered, who are these mysterious figures? Who gets to choose them? What's their brief? What are they doing all day? Where are they sitting even? I don't even know that.
And it makes me think, perhaps there really is a secret inner circle blocking access to all the information that everyone has a right to know. The mistakes, the cock-ups, the illegal goings-on. And if these people exist, will Sarah and I be able to find them?
Do you ever wonder how celebrities order food? Like, is Sarah Paulson a Diet Coke or a regular Coke girlie?
Some peasant Coke? No.
Or how does Sofia Vergara order a pizza?
No tomatoes. I cannot eat tomatoes.
Yes. Are you killed mushrooms?
Not really.
Okay. If these are the details you need, and I know you do, I have the podcast for you. I'm Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and on my podcast, Dinner's on Me, I take some notable friends of mine out to dinners in Los Angeles and New York City. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That thing was delicious.
In the 1970s, John Todd burst onto the evangelical scene with a shocking tale. He claimed to be a former witch, involved in a then unheard of secret organization called the Illuminati, and urged Christians to prepare for a violent world takeover.
First of all, the number one weapon in everybody's home should be a 12-gauge pump shotgun.
Hear the amazing story of one of the originators of the modern-day conspiracy theory. From Magnificent Noise and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Cover Up, the Conspiracy Tapes.
In episode 5, we were introduced to Lord Mountbatten, head of the Royal Navy, a member of the royal family, and a man with an aquiline nose and piercing gaze. We heard how close he was to the royals, how the Queen loved him and called him Dicky. And we also heard how this pillar of the establishment had a very private side. So I asked Mountbatten's biographer, Andrew Lowney, the one with the light curly hair and kindly smile, if he knows anything more about Mountbatten's hidden double life. And he says yes, he does.
He had a long interest in clandestine warfare. He'd always worked very closely with SIS.
SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, better known as MI6. Lowney says Mountbatten was involved in special operations during the war, secret raids, dirty tricks. And these operations, they always had one thing in common. They were deniable.
So he was a guy prepared to think outside the box, and he played to win. He didn't always play fair. He had a great regard for the secret world. He certainly knew a lot of spooks. He loved that world, and he enjoyed, I suppose, operating outside conventional systems.
In the previous episode, I asked Lowney about whether Mountbatten could have known Lionel Crabbe. Because although he's found no mention of Crabbe in Mountbatten's private diaries, perhaps they worked together at some point.
It's very likely he would have come across Crabbe. He was also, of course, a very keen diver, and so would have been interested in any of these diving operations.
And Mountbatten, like Crabbe, was bisexual, and both loved living dangerously.
I found a man who'd been a chauffeur in 1948 who was instructed by senior naval officers to find out where the male brothel in Malta was, because Mountbatten would want to go there.
This was dangerous territory for Mountbatten, illegal territory. And he knew those risks all too well, but he loved the thrill of taking risks. So I show Lowney the Daily Mirror's front page splash about Mountbatten, the suggestion he was involved in Lionel Crabbe's dive.
You know Mountbatten well. I mean, you've studied him for so long. He could have authorised a rogue operation like this.
Absolutely. I mean, he loved dirty tricks and secret operations. Someone said that if he swallowed a nail, he was so crooked it would come out a corkscrew. So I think it's very, very likely that he would have had some involvement. He was a sort of boy's own adventurer, and this just fits that mold perfectly. Mm. He had the authority to give the instructions. He had the character to do so. And Mountbatten must have been at the centre of it as the head of the Navy. And he had a long history of association with intelligence, particularly naval intelligence. So it's inconceivable that in the position he had and given his background that he wouldn't have known about this. And so his claims not to know anything really don't stand up to scrutiny.
But if he was involved in the Crabbe dive, he'd surely have met with Crabbe.
There are talks, certainly, of Mountbatten meeting Crabbe at Cowdrey Park, which is next door to the Broadlands Estate.
The Broadlands Estate, Mountbatten's vast country retreat. It's not far from Portsmouth.
And I think any meeting would have been done somewhere like Broadlands, away from scrutiny. You certainly wouldn't have met in a club or a public place.
And everything would have been extremely secret, because secrecy was central to Mountbatten's makeup.
So my instinct is that there would have been a need to know for this operation. It would have been a very tight group of planners. Mountbatten may have been at the top of this operation, but he would have clearly delegated the roles to senior planners.
People like MI6 agent Nicholas Elliott. And the planning would have been word of mouth, which explains the absence of any paper trail.
There would be no correspondence, there would be no contact once the initial decision was made.
Although Lowney's never found anything linking Mountbatten to Crabbe, he did make a disturbing discovery when looking through Mountbatten's papers. All the files about diving operations in Portsmouth had been destroyed.
And I've looked very, very closely also in adjacent files, where sometimes things get copied in, and it's been completely dry cleaned. Everything is gone.
What he's saying, it's shocking. Someone has gone through those files and removed everything that could implicate Mountbatten, the Queen's beloved Dickie, in the Lionel Crabbe affair. So let's just take stock of all this. Andrew Lowney's convinced Lord Mountbatten knew of Lionel Crabbe's mission and almost certainly ordered it to go ahead. Approached Nicholas Elliott in MI6, told him to set it up. Is this why Whitehall's placed a 100-year ban on the Crabbe file being released? Is it because this rogue mission was ordered by Lord Mountbatten, a man at the very heart of the royal family? Next time, in the final episode of Ministry of Secrets.
There are things that I'm not allowed to tell you because I can't let you broadcast it. So you have to turn that off.
Want the full story? Unlock all episodes of Cover Up Ministry of Secrets ad-free right now by subscribing to The Binge. All episodes, all at once. Plus, you'll unlock brand new stories dropping every month. That's all episodes, all at once, all ad-free. Just click subscribe on the top of the Cover Up Ministry of Secrets show page on Apple Podcasts or visit getthebinge.com to get access wherever you listen. Find out more about The Binge and other podcasts from Sony Music Entertainment at sonymusic.com/podcasts. Cover Up Season 1, Ministry of Secrets, is a Something Else and Sony Music Entertainment production. It's hosted and written by me, Giles Milton. The producer is Sarah Peters. The junior producer is Martha Miller. The production coordinator is E.K. Egbitola. Peggy Sutton is the story consultant. Jeremy Wormsley composed the original music, with mixing and sound design from Peregrine Andrews. Isis Thompson is the editor and executive producer, with thanks to actor Peter Temple and Tuning Fork Productions.